2, Establish the Edge. I'm your host, Mike Leone, back with part 7 of the Establish the Edge off-season projection special with Ben Gretsch. Today, we're going to be tackling the AFC West. Tomorrow, we'll be tackling the NFC West and wrapping up all 8 divisions. Make sure you check those out on the Establish the Edge podcast feed. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify. You can also check us out at the Establish the Run YouTube channel. Can catch all of Ben's work at Yards Per Gretsch on Twitter and bengretsch.substack.com for his Stealing Signals newsletter. Ben, let's kick it off with the Kansas City Chiefs. Always a fun team, and we've got them projected so crazy close in terms of play calling. We each have them like just a hair under 65 plays per game and right around a 65.5% called pass rate. One of the more predictable teams in the NFL because there's been so much stability there. And especially in terms of pass rate over expectation, they're always among the league leaders. So we can pretty much count on them to throw at a high clip, even though they're winning games quite frequently in good game scripts. So yeah, it's just another year of Mahomes chucking it around. Good to be a Kansas City fan.
Yeah. Yeah. The high pass rate over expected, the high play volume. I did have a little note here. They slowed it down a little bit in 2022 in terms of play volume from 2020 and 2021. And I had this sort of Galbraith thought about where they are in like a multi-year stretch where they're sort of reaching this moment where they're not pushing too hard in the regular season. They're kind of holding some things back for the postseason. I feel like the Bills are maybe approaching that too because they've had so many good regular seasons and haven't had necessarily the playoff success. I feel like the Kansas City was definitely doing that last year. By comparison, like some of these teams like the Chargers that we're going to get to in this division, the Bengals we've talked about, they're still sort of still testing their limits of their regular season capabilities. Or that's my little note here. So Kansas City slowed down a little bit last year. We're both projecting them a little bit more like last year than the years prior. There's still plenty of volume in this offense, right? It's not like a big deal.
Yeah, and they're still, you know, last year they were plus 10.8% in terms of pass rate over expectation, throwing at basically the exact clip that we're projecting this year, the 65.6% pass rate, despite an expected pass rate of just 55%. So extremely safe offense for pass volume, and with Mahomes at the helm, extremely safe offense for efficiency along with that volume. On Mahomes' line, we've maybe over-regressed his touchdown rate a little bit, something I'm going to look into, but you've got him pushing towards 40 touchdowns. We've got 34 touchdowns, which even if we meet in the middle there, though, like it is a meaningful difference in terms of I've kind of got him a clear tier behind. I shouldn't say a tier behind Allen and Hurts, but like a mini drop off behind those guys. But he's so safe that, you know, you can make an argument that he's just like right alongside those guys just because of the safety aspect of things. And the market certainly has it that way thus far.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I'm looking at the implied team totals for the season that we've referenced a few times. Shout out Jack Miller's hard work on that. And I have Kansas City like right at their projected team total. Now I have them leaning aggressively toward passing TDs relative to rushing TDs. But I do, yeah, I mean, I have Mahomes projected for almost 40 TDs, but in terms of this expected touchdown metric I built off of those implied team totals, I'm actually above market on Buffalo and Philly, and Kansas City's expected team totals are meaningfully higher than both Buffalo's and Philly's, so that's kind of interesting. In 4-point TD, though, I mean, I run a little hotter on my projections when we talk about this on the show. In 4-point per TD, I still have Hurts and Allen ahead of Mahomes. In 6-point, this high pass TD number you're referencing, 39.6 in my projection, does push Mahomes ahead of them.
Yeah, that's a good note. I know we have Mahomes like just one slot behind Allen in our underdog rankings, which is 4-point passing touchdown. But part of that is also Mahomes has the best ADP of the bunch. We're weighting that somewhat. It's actually like the market has him kind of meaningfully ahead of Allen and Hurts. Mm-hmm. Now, underdog ADP, it's important to keep in mind that stacking influences ADP there, though. And Chase and Kelsey being correlated pieces at the beginning, middle of the first round, I think does inflate Mahomes' ADP relative to where he would go if stacking wasn't like so prevalent there. But I'm taking a look at our 6-point per passing touchdown, and you know, we've got him obviously up relative to those guys in those ranks, even though we have the other two a little bit higher, but it's closer. I'm going to take a look at our pass touchdown projection. Either way, though, I think like he's with those three guys. I do slightly prefer Allen and Hurts because of the ground ability for and 4-point passing touchdown. Let's go to running back, where, you know, this is a fun team to talk about, because as kind of obvious as they are from a play calling standpoint, and there's like not too much to quibble about over Mahomes, where a lot of this, you know, you mentioned they have like by far the highest team total in the league, average spread out across the year. It's somewhat difficult to parse exactly how to eke value out of that in terms of the skill players behind Travis Kelce, Kelce being the obvious one. And it starts at running back with Isaiah Pacheco, who you've got for 216 carries. We've got 485 carries, but similar amount of targets. We're a little bit lower in terms of the full season fantasy point projection at around 170 to your 190. And that's mostly the carry discrepancy. I think we're pretty close on efficiency and receiving there. Both have Jerick McKinnon as second in line with around 60 carries and over 50 targets. And then CH as the third guy. And that's where we're putting a few more carries than you are right now. We've got CH with 65 carries. You've got 48. And then Denarik Prince, rookie, is fourth in line. And neither of us have a meaningful projection on him right now, but he is someone that has garnered a little bit of hype lately. So how are you seeing the backfield shake out?
Yeah, no, I mean, I've been worried that I've been seeing CH too favorably. And when I've kind of spitballed that take off a few people, I've gotten the comment back, you know, Prince looks like he might play on special teams, kind of similar to what led to Pacheco being active on game day. CH might be sort of in the Rojo situation, like inactive on game day as the fourth back. I mean, I kind of doubt that we're going to go with, you know, Pacheco and Prince. Pacheco's still very young, obviously takes over the backfield, majority of the backfield midseason last year, but probably not someone they can totally trust. I think there is an element with CEH where, like, yeah, I mean, like, he hasn't really been what they wanted him to be, but he's been there long enough that he knows the system, he knows the offense. I just don't think, like, Pacheco and Prince and McKinnon as your active game day running backs. Like, I do think CEH is going to be active. So anyway, I thought I was going to come in a little bit hot. I like your numbers more, honestly. I like the split a little bit better, where you guys are moving a little more towards CEH. And I do think he's a really viable last round best ball pick. I mean, people are just sick of him, but especially like if something were to happen to Pacheco, I think it's very clearly going to be CH, just for like, look, our offense is a passing offense. You're the guy that won't screw anything up, you know, sort of thing. Like, we're not going to necessarily go to Prince, or, you know, obviously McKinnon can fill some of it and we'll continue to play his role, but he's probably not going to be a 20 carry back or anything like that. So I do think as like a pure handcuff, CH is probably the play there as well. It's an interesting backfield for sure. Pacheco, I was surprised to see in looking into him, 170 carries last year, only 14 targets in the regular season. He did have 7 in 3 playoff games, but that's like a really, you know, heavy lean towards just the rushing, which is kind of weird in terms of the lack of receiving, because he did have good efficiency. I looked at his carries per game sort of after he took over, right around week 10, he started taking over like starts and the main share of the backfield. And kind of split out my carries for the season based on sort of how that role played out down the stretch and into the playoffs. I do think he's probably going to have that role going into the year. But yeah, I mean, I think CH is kind of a fun way to play this backfield really late.
Yeah, I mean, it's cheap. It's a cheap access to the offense. And, you know, we talked about Cordarrelle Patterson on one of the recent shows. There's some similarities to me there where, like, I don't know if it's like an absolute home run pick, but like you could get a lot of like usable weeks out of it, where yeah, he's just seeing enough volume in a really good offense, not going to be, you know, not good enough to be the workhorse back that, you know, people hoped when he was drafted in the first round, that Kansas City hoped. But yeah, I'm with you. I kind of like him a little bit better than our ranks as an 18th round pick, sort of depending on need. Like if I'm swinging pure upside, I'm not going with CH, but if I'm kind of like, man, like I'm a little fragile at running back, like I'll throw CH on there and feel like kind of confident that he's going to have a chance to at least contribute to my roster if things go poorly in front of it. I've taken Pacheco and McKinnon. Both for me are guys that, like, when they slip around past ADP, I'm fine taking them. I'm probably not taking them at ADP right now, unless it's like just a really specific, I need a running back and they're top of my board.
That's how I am too with both of them.
Yeah. It's pretty lukewarm take, but yeah, that's where I'm at. McKinnon, of course, flashed like kind of the most individual upside last year. I know in DFS, I was playing Pacheco a lot down the stretch and felt like he kind of ran pretty bad relative to McKinnon, and McKinnon ran really pure, but you know, it's priced appropriately now, especially after that, the way the playoffs ended for McKinnon was kind of weird. I don't know if he was fully healthy, but it seems like Pacheco wasn't fully healthy either. As far as Prince, is this just kind of like a wait and see approach for like redraft managed? Like, are you taking any of him in best ball?
Yeah, I think he's a wait and see for sure. I mean, I think he's a good example of the type of late round running back that can be a dead roster spot, which you warned about in the best ball manifesto as, you know, something we want to try to avoid in earlier drafts. Even if he is active for special teams, he could very easily be a dead spot for best ball teams as just like a guy who's not getting a lot of playing time and offensive touches, right? Like, just because it happened with Pacheco last year doesn't mean it's going to happen with Prince again this year.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's go to wide receiver. And, you know, as unsure as we are at running back, like wide receiver is even more interesting when you've got the quarterback who's favored to lead the league in passing yards, lead the league in passing touchdowns, and, you know, don't really have very rich wide receiver ADP. And it was strange last year, Gretch, the way this played out is like, it was the Travis Kelce show and none of the wide receivers really ended up mattering that much, which seems nuts that Mahomes had the season that he did, one of his best statistical seasons to date, and no wide receiver really mattered in fantasy, you know, in a meaningful way. Like Juju had a few weeks there where he was solid and had some upside, but mostly a bust where he was taken in the fifth, sixth round. I was really high on him. MVS was out there. Sky Moore disappointed in a huge way in his rookie way. So just really weird year. Now you've got a setup where Kadarius Toney is the clear one in terms of ADP here, but Toney just for whatever reason has not been able to stay on the field with the Giants or with Kansas City. So there's a lot of opportunity here. Is someone going to take it? I guess we'll find out. You and I both have Toney around 90 targets. You have him a little bit more efficient. And again, I think we might be a touch light on Mahomes' efficiency, so it probably flows through to these receivers a little bit. Where we start to differ is you've got Sky Moore at 91 targets, matching Toney as the co-number one. We've only got 53 targets and big range of outcomes for Sky Moore. The rookie season, I'm just really worried about the rookie season. It was really disappointing in a spot where like he should have had a clear runway, but he does have the runway again year two. And he's a prospect I know that you liked just in isolation of anything else. You just liked more as a prospect coming in, as did a lot of us.
Yeah, one of the things I'm maybe putting a little too much weight on is a note I heard early in the offseason. I can't even remember where to attribute it, but that Andy Reid rookie, and I haven't even looked into it. So I'm like, this is definitely putting too much weight on something when you haven't even double checked if it's valid. But that Andy Reid, the rookie receivers under Andy Reid have traditionally not done much. And it just sort of, you know, passed the sniff test for me. I do think it was one of those things where, like, situationally last year, they bring in veteran. I mean, they lose Tyreek Hill, but they bring in veterans, Juju, MVS, and they wanted to sort of give those guys the first crack. Sky Moore did, I think, struggle to earn the opportunity, and that's always a red flag. But I do think their movement after, you know, 1 year to let Juju walk, and then the conversation this offseason in terms of a lot of positive notes about Sky Moore coming out of Kansas City so far this offseason. I mean, I was pretty snake bitten on him last year. I drafted him in quite a few places, but I have come back around to where I think he can be an interesting upside wide receiver option, sort of outside that wide receiver window we've talked about a little bit, where, you know, in drafts you get past like the 10th round, you get to where he's going and maybe the 11th, and it's a tricky spot for wide receiver ceiling or upside plays. He is a profile that, to me, you know, in this offense, we just talked about how, you know, Mahomes could throw 40 touchdowns as like a baseline projection. You know, it is a play I'm willing to make, but I do think our two projections are, you know, a great look at like the whole range of outcomes, right?
Yeah.
Like I have kind of the more optimistic one. You have kind of maybe the more pessimistic one, or maybe realistic, you might say. The flip side of that is you guys are like almost doubled me on Richie James targets, and he's another way to play this offense that like Richie James pretty solid with the Giants last year. I found out doing this projection that it's actually kind of congested for routes. I only project five receivers. So I did MVS, Tony, Sky, the rookie Rashee Rice, and Richie James. But then I didn't even do Justin Watson, who was like a, you know, ran a lot of routes for them last year. And given those guys, you know, it's tough for Rashee Rice to see playing time, I think, as a rookie, again, similar to what Sky Moore dealt with last year. Justin Ross is another guy that's been, you know, talked about and a guy that I really liked as a prospect, but he was on IR all of last year. But like for him to crack the field, there's a lot of names ahead of him. And then they do the thing that they did quite a bit last year. They were top five in they were fifth in 12 personnel on first downs and sixth in 13 personnel, meaning two tight ends and three tight end formations. They're below average in 11 personnel. They ran those packages a lot last year where they got Noah Gray and Jody Fortson out on the field together. And so those guys are going to play some too. One of the things that we saw from the Chiefs last year was just that fluidity of like personnel groupings that led to more of the distribution of targets. So yeah, a lot of question marks here, but I think you kind of just got to throw out some of the projections and make your bets on like, you know, archetypes and profiles if you want to, you know, make your swings.
Yeah, I think we'll probably come up on the Sky Moore projection some. We're pretty conservative, as you mentioned. Like, we have some volume for Richie James. We do have some volume for Justin Watson. Still have a little bit of unlisted volume. Just, it does seem like the DeAndre Hopkins threat is pretty unlikely to happen here for Kansas City. So, might eliminate that and start to apply it to, you know, Sky in particular, who's probably the guy that we're light on. And, you know, I mentioned that like last year, no wide receiver really hit, but part of that was like the cost on Juju. Like he put up 80 catches, nearly 80 catches and 1,000 yards. You know, our projections right now, Gretch, like we don't have anyone really coming close to that. So if someone even has a Juju type season with these ADPs, Tony might need a little bit more, but the rest of the guys would pay off, you know, especially if they can just find the end zone a little bit more than Juju did. So it's tough. It's so boring, but just due to ADP, I've taken MVS a decent bit. I think, you know, we hit on the redrafters best ball differences a lot and how it's like counterintuitive what most people think. And I think MVS is yet another example where in best ball, I'm like, this dude's going to be on the field. I'm pretty confident in that. He's going to have some spike weeks. I don't have to decide when to start him. I'd rather have him than Sky Moore, I think.
Yeah, he's a super funny when you look at his you look at just his rate stats. 4.7 targets per game last year. His last 2 years in Green Bay were 4.8 and 5.0. He's always been this sort of like middling targets per out run guy, but it's at a high A dot, and he's been efficient. I mean, he's had great quarterbacks as well, but efficient in Green Bay. I think people and ADP wanted him to take a step forward last year. He did it, but he also was just the exact same guy, and you can rely on that. He's the most stable thing here. You can chalk him up for 80 targets and good efficiency.
Yeah. And then in managed league, though, like, you know, give me this guy more upside that he could break out. Like, MVS isn't breaking out. You know, it's not going to have this huge impact in a sit-em, start-em league. So, in general, and we talked, too, a lot about just our philosophy in general in terms of how we're drafting and how projections factor into that. But definitely as you get out of the first 8 to 9 rounds, you really start to see the best ball versus redraft divergence, in my opinion, where you start to throw the projections out the window a lot earlier in managed than you do in best ball, just because the way those formats and those games work and the risk reward on players. But Rice is the guy right now that I think is probably the worst bet, as even though he's the rookie that, like, normally you would say, like, hey, let's go after the rookie who they drafted because nobody else popped. But he seems like the worst bet to me of the bunch. Just wasn't a prospect we really liked. You mentioned the stuff with Kansas City that in the rookie receivers, which, you know, neither of us have confirmed, but we're just going to roll with it.
Yeah,
I don't know. I think he might be the worst bet at cost.
That's where I landed on this projection too. But again, I came in optimistic on Sky. I think if you think Sky Moore is a bust, you can make the Rashee Rice play. The reason we didn't really like him as a prospect, didn't have a ton of production until senior year, but did have 96 catches, 1,300 yards, 10 touchdowns, at SMU last year as a senior. A lot of times that upperclassman production gets sort of discounted, but we don't see a lot of small school guys go pro early anyway. And that, I mean, that's big reception numbers. That's pretty big production, just raw production. I'm a little bit interested in him to sort of hedge some of my Sky Moore excitement that, like, if Sky Moore's bad, someone, I guess it could be Tony and MVS and like Richie James probably. Yeah. I mean, it might be tight for Rice.
Yeah. Let's go to tight end with Kelsey. The big thing to talk about, I mean, we've got monster projections on Kelsey. I've got 146 targets. You've got 150. We've got him both clearing 100 catches, over 1,200 yards, double-digit touchdowns. I mean, we have projected a monster season, and he's one of, you know, I hate to be redundant because I know we've said this on the pod before, but one of a few guys where you start to worry about age, and then he has an amazing year, and it's like now all of a sudden we don't care about the age anymore. Mm-hmm. So Silva and I just had a man versus machine podcast on Established to Run. I was a bit more pro Kelsey. He was, I thought, too low on Kelsey, but I kind of got his angle where, like, you do try to get ahead on it, but the makeup of this team is just like, he's just decent. Everything we talked about wide receiver just means like Travis Kelsey should dominate. Even if one of those wide receivers emerges, he should dominate. So how are you?
And his efficiency's remained unreal. And yeah, like you said, there's just no threat to him getting like alpha targets. If you're doing a projection, there's no threat. Like he can get all the targets.
So where are you comfortable taking him, I guess, in the first round? I've been taking him kind of only when he falls a little bit past ADP. So like seventh or eighth, you know, I don't want to get like too micro, but like, in general, in the first round, or even in like tight end premium, FFPC main events come around, like you've got like the fourth overall pick. Like, are you taking Travis Kelsey in tight end premium?
I don't think I'm jumping him that high, even in tight end premium, because I do really like the top five as sort of its own tier. So it's like, I think there's a pretty big tier break. I do think the positional advantage he could offer you is worth taking that risk in the like 6, 7, 8 range, like you said. He is a guy that I'm with Silva, like kind of wanting to get out ahead, a little bit concerned about, like, will it play out that way again this year, where he just dominates everything? And the other tight ends really doing nothing last year, but there can be other tight ends coming up to get closer to him potentially this year in scoring. So he's one that I want to have some exposure to because he can legitimately be the most important player in fantasy. But I think I'm going to be like slightly underweight, like overall, and trying to manage where I'm taking my spots on him.
I think I'm mostly in line with you there. My take might be a little different on format, where like I think he goes a little too early in these half PPR leagues, but like tight end premium, he could just, we saw it last year. Like, it was insane, the positional edge he had. By pure numbers, we have him number two in our FFPC ranks. I do think like, I'm probably taking Chase and CMC ahead of him. I do think I would take Kelsey fourth over like Eckler, Tyree,
over Cup.
I think so, but like Cup, I have some concerns that the Rams just implode. That I think, gotcha. Like, if I've got both those systemic concerns, like, then I'm just going to go with Kelsey, who we have projected better. It's sort of the way I'm looking at it, but it's tough. I mean, there's a pretty good top seven this year. For sure, in tight end premium.
For sure. We spent a long time on the Chiefs, but I mean, that's like the best offense in the league and uncertainty everywhere. So, like, it's a good team to talk through for sure.
Yeah. And I mean, we're going to go to the Chargers. Like, this is a fun division to talk through. And we've got a monster projection on the Chargers plays per game at 67. Like, we normally do not project teams this aggressively, but last season, you know, the Chargers ran like 68 plays per game, just under 68. Two seasons ago, they're at 66.4, and they go out and they get Kellen Moore, who plays really fast and played really fast in Dallas as their offensive coordinator. And it just seems clear that this team, in terms of how, you know, analytics friendly they are, like, they want to be up tempo and they want to throw. We both have them around a 64% pass rate. So this is the offense that I feel like could really break fantasy. they're different from the Chiefs in that they have like a bunch of key players that we feel a lot better about, but they do all have their warts a little bit. So it's still really interesting to talk through. You're a little tamer on the Chargers, having them at 65.8 plays per game, which is still really high, but similar.
Which is still my highest project. So I actually love that you guys are at 67, because I like in my notes, I'm like, all right, they've been at least 66.4 3 years straight. Kellen Moore has these fast offenses in Dallas. I mean, we talk about with pace often, it's, you know, the play caller, the coordinator, or the quarterback also has a big part of it. This quarterback has led really fast offenses. This coordinator's led really fast offenses. I mean, we should be expecting this to be a really fast offense. And I'm always questioning, like, when I have a really strong stance like this, how much do I regress in a projection? Because when you get way out away from the mean, like, are you just really inflating everything in that team's projection? But I really kind of love that you guys are like, look, we're just going to project it at 67 plays per game. And I mean, yeah, like that's not even how many they had last year. Like, you don't have to regress it that much if you're this confident. I think it's right.
Yeah, it's tough too. Like, and we're not normally like too bold. In fact, I don't think we have another team above 65 plays per game. I think Kansas City, who we just did at 65, is our second. And I remember when we talked about this, we're like, it feels right in isolation. It feels wrong to have any team two plays ahead of any other team.
Right.
But it just seems really unlikely that they would be lower than this. I guess the case is that you would see more efficiency out of Herbert, higher ADOT, and then that kind of takes some plays off the field, which is sort of the reverse of what we're expecting for like a Miami, for example, where they were so efficient in terms of yards per attempt and stuff that they probably had fewer plays per drive than they would regardless of pace of play, just because of that. And there is always with projections a really interesting push and pull on efficiency versus volume, especially in terms of how we regress. We're like, we're keen to regress the efficiency, but then we buy into the volume a bit more. And sometimes we can over, I guess, rate the volume side of things as a result of that. But with all that said, I'm still extremely bullish on the Chargers. We've got Justin Herbert, both of us, at about 340 fantasy points over the course of the season and 4 point per passing touchdown leagues. I know for us, that puts him at QB7. We're like right in line with his ADP, but we're behind on some of the, you know, the early quarterbacks. So I'm really into Herbert this year. He's also pretty easy to stack. I think he's a good fifth, sixth round pick. Like, I think he's similar to the fifth, sixth round picks last year that went off that provided a lot of upside for teams when they hit. And this year, those other quarterbacks that hit have all been pushed up the draft board a bit more.
Yeah, I've been kind of a late round QB slappy so far because of the just price increases. But I think you just kind of turn that light on in my head. We're like, yeah, I mean, fifth, sixth on Herbert in this atmosphere and everything we're talking about with the potential volume, I think he's a really good pick there as well.
Let's go to Eckler, who I remember doing the legendary running back episode that I do with Pat Corain, who always has a really good article on legendary running back upside each season, kind of detailing like what it takes for these backs to actually be worth an early round pick, and then specifically going through the case for all the backs. And Eckler was the one that we had trouble with because we were like, 2 years ago, you know, he had all this reception, but then he lost it last year. And it's like, last year he scored all these touchdowns and he still didn't quite get there. What are the chances he scores all these touchdowns again? And then he sort of did both last season and he gets there. I'm still pretty high on Eckler, almost as a function of just being super high on this offense. And there's, you know, in terms of running backs, he's got to be among the expected target leaders. You've got him for 95 targets. We've got him for 90, both just under 1,000 rushing yards. We've each got him for around 14 touchdowns, about between receiving and rushing. So pretty big season. And I know for us, he's been tough in terms of drafting just because these rooms are so, you kind of want to take a wide receiver in the middle of round one based on how these rooms have been, especially on underdog. But from a value perspective, we really do have Eckler as like pretty strong value even in half PPR in that middle of the first round.
Yeah, I mean, I got done with this projection and I was like, man, there's a case that he's just the RB1 this year. I mean, he's getting up there in age. He asked for a trade this offseason. There's some other concerns, but if we're this optimistic about this offense, he's the high value touch, God. I mean, obviously Christian McCaffrey is as well, but with 20 and 18 touchdowns the last couple of years, getting all those green zone, and for those who aren't familiar with the high value touches, I mean, it's green zone touches, the close into the end zone touches, and then receptions. And he obviously has the massive receiving role, 107 catches last year. His targets per out run were just absolutely through the roof. We know they want to get their Justin Herbert's A dot up and throw down the field more. I really did try to nuke Eckler's receiving as a result, kind of trying to push the downfield stuff. But there's also not really like an obvious, like they haven't upgraded their backup situation. Isaiah Spiller was sort of a bust last year as the rookie. And then the rest of it is just Joshua Kelly, Larry Roundtree, the same guys as last year that, didn't do a whole lot. And I mean, even as I try to sort of like limit the passing to Eckler, one of the realities with Herbert is he's not a huge scrambler. So there is going to be check down. Like, he's comfortable with that. Like, my first projection, I wound up with Herbert's A dot, because I do A dots in my projections. Herbert's A dot going way up, like too high. And it's like, there's a reason that his A dot has been, even relative to his early career seasons. And there's a reason it's been reasonably low, because he does take those checkdowns. He will throw underneath a decent amount. So anyway, I mean, I wound up with 95 targets for Eckler again. That's still a knockoff from last year. Our touchdowns are a knockoff from his last 2 years at about 14, as you mentioned. And yet we're still both projecting 300-point seasons. I mean, like, when you have that type of point-scoring profile in an offense that's going to run this many plays, it's pretty nice. It's pretty sexy.
Yeah, definitely. And I think Eckler last year is kind of a case of, like, how sometimes the things just happen to come together in terms of the touchdowns and the receptions, and that's sort of the value of doing the projections is, like, you might think of him as, like, not – a legendary upside guy if you're just looking at, like, oh, he scored this many touchdowns without getting there. And then sometimes you just run a little pure on both, and now, as we're saying, it's like he almost doesn't even have to run pure. There's room for regression and him still to get there, so it's wild stuff. But behind him, pretty valuable handcuff spot. We've got different takes on this in the projections. You've got this leaning towards Isaiah Spiller a bit more. We've got it leaning towards Joshua Kelly. And I might have taken for granted, it just seemed like Kelly was, the backup down the stretch last year and Spiller was a bust. Maybe I buried Spiller a little bit too quickly here. So curious to hear what you have to say here. Sounded like, especially in the 20-round DraftKings drafts, like, pretty easy to draft Josh Kelly in like rounds 19 and 20, but I don't want to be doing that if there's like, if it's 50-50 between him and Spiller.
Yeah, I'm kind of thumbing the scale here a little. It's probably at least 60-40 to Kelly. Spiller only had 21 touches last year. Not a great look. Part of the reason I'm sort of thumbing the scale, Spiller did have an interesting profile coming out of college, and we only got 21 touches last year. So, like you said, it's a valuable number two spot. I don't think the upside is really there with Joshua Kelly based on what we've seen. He was slightly more efficient last year, but still pretty, inefficient, basically. Doesn't look like a guy that's going to really do a lot if the role opens up. Spiller is the guy that I think there's more uncertainty in. I think in best ball, probably you make the play towards Kelly because he's the one that seems much more likely to be the actual handcuff. In managed, I probably want to take the swing on Spiller and see if I'm going to take one of them and see if, hey, if I get this right, there's some actual upside here, because his profile was a little bit intriguing.
That makes sense. And I do think it's a situation where if you can get ahead of camp news, like, there's always a lag, and like, maybe we start getting a clear picture of this at some point in early August. And if you start to get a lean there, even if it's off like a little bit of news, it might be worth for a week, drafting that player like pretty heavily who you think maybe has a leg up based on some beat report that, if it doesn't come true, like, it's a late round dart throw, it's not like the end of the world, but if it does come to fruition and you're ahead, like, it's a really big deal in terms of your best ball exposures.
Let's go. Because there is those legs. That's a great, like, just hammer it for a week. I love it.
Yeah. I think Corain was telling me he did that a lot last year, where you know, he'd kind of, because he's always reading the Athletic and parsing through the beat writer quotes and stuff. And it's like, when you get to the point where the risk in these late round picks is so low, like, it is worth the reward of like, is this true? Probably not. But if it is, we're rolling. But let's go to receiver. Keenan Allen is like the Travis Kelce of the Chargers in terms of a guy that, you know, I remember last year it was like, no, in the ETR Slack, it was like, we got to dock Keenan Allen. We can't draft this guy. We got to dock him, you know, and it's like the projections show him to be good. And then, you know, his yards per out run, which was declining with his age, all of a sudden goes the other way. And now he seems like the clear safest guy for targets. We've got him at 128 targets. You have him at 153 targets, over 100 catches overall. So we both have him for pretty bullish seasons, you even higher. And I started to come around to him, you know, when we start getting in that spot in the late third round for receivers where like it starts to get iffy on some of these guys. I think I like Keenan Allen more than Calvin Ridley, which is like kind of gross when you look at like how you think of the players in terms of like old possession receiver versus this guy who was, you know, in Dynasty 2 years ago, one of the top guys, and is still in his late 20s, still kind of more in his peak years.
I have Keenan Allen projected for like, I'm looking it up right now, 36 more points than Calvin Ridley. I mean, I think I like him more than Ridley as well. There's a lot of risk there. Keenan, like you said, is per route numbers. He missed some time, so it kind of masked it a little bit, but the per route numbers reversed last year. The efficiency bounced back in a way that it had been sort of a multi-year decline, and he showed he still has some, you know, juice in the tank, and the targets per out run still very solid. The rate of targets here, I mean, so if you just look like his targets per game, he played two games early in the season last year, week one, and then when he came back in week seven, left them both early, 33%, 32% of the snaps in those games. But if you look from week 11 on when he returned, I mean, 8 targets, 7 targets, 14, 14, 9, 14, 6, 11, and then 13 in the playoff game where they played from ahead mostly. I mean, I don't have the exact average right here, but that's just a lot of targets. And if you, when I was doing the projection, I was looking at that. I wound up, I mean, just extrapolating his numbers from the regular season, not including that postseason game, and including the two games where we left early, you're basically at 150 target season. The year prior, 2021, 157 targets in 16 games. The year prior to that, 147 and 14. Now we're getting younger and younger. That's this age 28 season. He's going to be 31 this year, but like he's never stopped earning volume. Like he's going to be the guy in this really high volume offense. The thing with Mike Williams is last year, he kind of took a step back on targets per route run. I think Keenan is just like the guy for the targets in this offense, and targets are massive.
Yeah, and I like the way you spelled that out, because I do think it's a spot where the projections really help you to see the range of outcomes. So we're at, after scaling and everything, at a 19.5% target share to get him at those 129 targets. We're being extremely conservative with that input on the age, and we have him as, you know, a third round pick. And to your point, over that stretch, his average target share, I did the average real quick while you were talking, was 27%. This guy that's probably getting 25% targets when he's healthy on the offense that we went through, and we project them to be among the league leaders in pass attempts between their pace and their pass rate over expectation. And we expect him to score too, right?
I mean, he can lead the league in targets this year. That's what you're doing. The math is there. He can, that doesn't mean he would be the wide receiver one necessarily, but he can legitimately compete with like Justin Jefferson and Jamar Chase for raw targets.
So we'll go to wide receiver two. I know talking to you in Discord, you were a little bit down on Mike Williams. I'm still up on him, mostly because I'm just up on the entire offense and like Mike Williams's explosiveness and the just kind of the vertical upside that he provides. But they drafted Quentin Johnston in the first round. I mostly think, you know, Josh Palmer is dead here, who I know that's music to your ears, Ben. And Johnston's thought of as a big play guy, and he is, but he's more of like a yak guy, and Mike Williams is more like the deep vertical threat, the way I understand it. Stepping out of my lane a little bit here in terms of the scouting element, but I kind of like them, both. I just like everybody on the Chargers offense. It comes down to that. It's that simple.
So Mike Williams' first four years of his career was between 16 and 17% targets per run every year. Rookie year, he had a 12.8 up, but after that, 15.6, 18.3, 15.8. Those are really high ADOTs. And in the 16 to 17% targets per run range, but with all those air yards, very much a vertical threat. The last two seasons, his targets per out run got up to a 21%, fell back down to 19.4 last year, but the ADOT came down to 12 and 12.7. Essentially, he was earning more targets in the short and intermediate range, which brought the ADOT down, helped the targets per route run. That's the exact stuff that, as you just described with Quentin Johnston, is sort of the yak guy that I think Johnston moving into the wide receiver three role hurts Williams' profile. He goes back to being primarily a downfield guy from how I'm sort of allocating the depths and the air yards and the way that this is going to distribute. And the concern for me there is part of the reason Herbert's ADOT came down so heavily last year was this cover two deep shell that all around the league teams are trying to take away those really deep shots. So does Mike Williams wind up sort of similar to what happened with Gabe Davis in Buffalo and some other places as this guy who's running a lot of vertical routes, but the safeties are always there and the passes are going underneath to Keenan Allen and to Quentin Johnston? That's the concern for me. After we had talked in Discord, as you alluded to, I did this projection and I did get a little bit more optimistic on him. His efficiency is really, really strong. I mean, Mike Williams is a gam for sure. I'm still open to taking him.
Yeah. And I think ultimately too, at least from a projection standpoint, the biggest thing is you have Palmer even further behind than we do. So we're very similar on Mike Williams' targets, right around 108, 109 targets. You've got Quentin at 99. We've got 78. Of course, I like to always inform people that we do upside cases on these rookies because you look historically, the base target shares for the rookies, it's a lot worse than you would expect. But we also know that because they elevate over the latter half of the season or the ones that do hit in a meaningful way, we want to account for that. So it can be difficult, but regardless, we're much more bearish on the base targets on Quentin Johnston. Most of that's coming from Palmer, who we have at 50 targets. You have at 31. I know I said I think Palmer's buried, but I've still taken him at the very end of drafts because I'm if anyone gets hurt, Palmer could maybe do what he did last year, which is suck and still score fantasy points. That was sort of my take at the very end, but I do wonder if we'll certainly follow this, but if Johnson's going to be playing from the get-go, we're for sure light on his target share, and we're also definitely light on his rankings. He's a really good value if you think he's the third wide receiver from the jump.
Which I kind of think with the first round draft capital is how I'm playing into it, because when Keenan and Mike Williams got hurt last year, the fact that Palmer had the opportunity to be the number one for a while and really didn't step up. No one else in this passing game really stepped up. You can kind of draw a pretty straight line between that and the first round Quentin Johnston pick. And I think they're ready to use him right away over the guys they have in house.
Okay, let's go to tight end. They've got Gerald Everett there. You've got 85 targets. We've got 72. We've got more targets kind of just to the backup tight ends here. Maybe need to concentrate that a little bit more. I know Everett's been one of these guys where on pure numbers, one of the few Chargers where we've been behind market on, but on feel, we're all kind of let's take Everett. And I think we did finally boost him up to the point where we've got him now at tight end 16 in our underdog rankings. And he's going off at tight end 18 ADP wise. But yeah, it's basically just playing the Chargers offense. He did have good flashes last year. I know you were a big fan of him last year, Ben. Are you back in on Gerald Everett for the second straight
year? Yeah, he's another one who struggled with the added opportunity. With both Allen and Williams missing time at the same time at times, I would have expected him to do a little bit more. Seeing that you guys have a little bit more volume than me for Donald Parham, I'm an old XFL fan as well. I know Levitan's probably hitting you up in the
Levitan forces us there's a minimum threshold we have to
projection. Yeah. I'm gonna probably move a few targets towards Parham away from Everett. Parham's sweet. He's still sweet. So that could be a legitimate threat to Everett, honestly. But I do like Everett. He's one of my favorite double-digit round tight ends, certainly, and especially like as like a stack bring back or just like a correlated play on, you know, a Judy pick or something. If I don't get one of the other receivers, I think Everett makes a lot of sense.
Cool. Let's go to Denver. And coaching change here. Hackett was so, so bad for Denver. And Russ was so, so bad. And we're going to find out for sure. You know, I said last year, we're going to find out if Russ or Seattle was the problem. And it certainly was not looking good for Russell Wilson with what Geno Smith did in Seattle and what Russell Smith did in Denver. But Russ gets somewhat of a second chance here with Sean Payton coming over. We've got them like league average in plays at 63.7. You're a little bit lower at 62.6, but we're dead on in terms of a called pass rate, which is just under 60% of the time. And yeah, I've been taking Russ in stacks. That's about it. I mean, that's kind of the case with all these quarterbacks, I think, that go in his range. It's like, oh, stack, great. If it's not a stack, you know, probably not taking him.
Yeah, that's how I view him. I have more of him than I even want because I you know, some of my early team, I took a decent amount of Judy, and some of my early teams also had some Sutton. And I like the Chargers receivers we were just talking about. So I wind up hitting that game early, and then I've been playing later on quarterback a little bit too much, and then I wind up with more Russell Wilson than I want to have in my portfolio. But, you know, there's a reasonable bounce back case. It's a weird, as far as pace goes, it's not surprising to me that this is one where we're off. It's a weird fit. Sean Payton teams historically were, you know, a little bit faster paced. They're pass happy. They're short passes, an extension of the run game. You have Drew Brees for several seasons throwing, you know, 650 times a year, tons of pass volume year in and year out. You can bank on it. I did notice in looking into Payton's old tendencies, late career Brees, the pass rate got pretty low. The pace slowed. You know, maybe it was like he was kind of protecting his quarterback a little bit more there, and maybe he'll feel similarly with Russ. Obviously, Russ teams have tended to be more slow pace, limited running back targets, you know, higher ADOT, scrambling around, taking sacks, chucking up deep balls. And so it's kind of been hard to figure out the pace for me between the quarterback and the coach, and also, you know, like how to handle like the running back targets, which was always a really high element in Sean Payton's offenses. Russ did throw the backs a decent amount last year, but yeah, I mean, it feels like there's a lot of ways this offense can go.
Yeah, and running back is somewhat difficult to parse because you've got Javonte Williams coming back from a really tough knee injury. I know early on in the offseason, I was really bearish, kind of full fading Javonte, and it seems like the news has trended positive. I've definitely grabbed him. Especially like in builds where I'm taking a lot of running backs, like these zero RB builds, I'm like, well, I'll just take Javonte. I'm going to take like four running backs in a row at this point. And, you know, hopefully on quantity, like I've covered some of the weeks early. I don't have almost like any conviction on Javonte right now. I'm still like slightly bearish, just a little snake bitten on Dobbins last year, who had a really rough knee injury as well. I don't think it was like the regular ACL tear for Javonte. It seemed like it was a little bit worse. So I know I've been more bullish on Breece Hall than Javonte coming back. And then with P. Ryan, Levitan loves P. Ryan. I do like P. Ryan. Sounds like he's going to have a legitimate role, whether Javonte is healthy or not. But we still do have a lot of work here to like nobody, which explains some of our discrepancies and projections. Ben, you've got 181 carries for Javonte. We've got 168. You've got 162 carries for P. Ryan. We've got 126. Just worried if like Javonte's not ready to start the season, like somebody else has to get some carries.
Yeah.
The depth chart is horrid right now behind these two guys, though.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, there's legitimately no like number three. I mean, their number three discussion is like Tyler Beatty, this Jaleel McLaughlin, who's a UDFA, small school guy, and undersized as well, but has already gotten some camp buzz. And then Tony Jones, who, you know, former Saint. It's funny. There's a lot of former Saints on this team. Sean Payton certainly bringing in some guys that he knew. But you're basically looking at Javonte and Piran as the only options. And so, I mean, is that a bullish argument for Javonte's health? Is that certainly when I did the projection, it led me to be more optimistic on Piran. I had been thinking of him as like an early season play where Javonte's maybe not fully healthy, but I mean, this projection got me into thinking like, well, I mean, he's also going to have a standalone role late in the season, even if Javonte's fully healthy, because there's no one. There's going to be a two-man backfield at this point. But I think you're right. I mean, this does seem like a spot where somebody could land. We have heard rumors. What was it? Right after Dalvin Cook got cut, this is one of the teams that got mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, they could sign someone, or they could just be like, Javonte misses a few games, and one of these guys who we think is real dusty just plays just because they have to play. You know, it seems unlikely that P. Ryan would be a bell cow. I think he'll have like a clear lead and in a really strong role. But when you're doing the carries over the course of the season, it's, you know, it does seem like there's going to be like 15 to 20% of these carries that just go to someone besides P. Ryan and Javonte Williams to me, but I'm not sure exactly how to dice that up. And yeah, a lot of it does come down to Javonte Williams' health at the end of the day and at what point he's ready and like what type of workload that's going to lead to.
For sure. And it's something that, you know, I kind of want to see more information on. I don't do great with these health things. I feel snake bitten by the Dobbins thing last year as well. And kind of just, you know, very similar to what you said, have been sort of following market in terms of the optimism for Breece and a little bit more caution for Javonte. He seems like a great value relative to his like skill set and the lack of depth in the depth chart. But like, if he's not healthy, if the knees, you know, needs another year, a lot of times it's the second year after that you actually get the full recovery, then he's fool's gold, right? So definitely have taken some of him, but I haven't been all over him. I've taken more P9.
One of the other man versus machine arguments me and Silva had recently was Jerry Jeudy and Courtland Sutton. And honestly, I don't have a ton of conviction in this take, but I know I said this in the Discord to you, Ben, and to Pat and Peter when we were talking. It doesn't totally make sense to me, even though some of the narratives line up in terms of the team wanting to get rid of Sutton, in terms of the types of players that, you know, they brought in like Marvin Mims. I get why the market's trending way towards Jeudy and way against Sutton. But last year, for whatever reason, Sutton was going in the third round, Jeudy was going in the fifth round. Now we've got Jeudy going at the 3-4 turn, and we've got Sutton falling to like double digit rounds, almost, maybe not quite, but like round 9, I've seen him there somewhat frequently. And, you know, ultimately they had pretty similar stat lines last year. You're just looking at base raw stats, which isn't the best way to do things, but in terms of like catch volume and games played, wasn't that crazy different. So like, I don't understand why the gap is this big, but I also don't have very much confidence that the market is wrong here necessarily.
Yeah, I think that's all well put. Jeudy's another one of those guys with a sneaky higher games played than actually like games played. He played one snap in one game, 38% mm-hmm. in the game he returned, and 14% in a third game. That's so a lot of empty routes, or they're not running a lot of routes in those three games. If you look at like the per route run stuff, he was meaningfully better than Sutton. He took a step forward again this year. If you just look at his profile on its own merits, I understand why people are excited, because he started out as a rookie. I'm trying to pull up his yards per run right now. I know it's year three this past year, which is first year over 2 yards per run. Started as a rookie, 1.66 yards per out run. Last year, 1.85, or excuse me, 2021, 1.85. And then last year, he gets up to 2.18. First time over 2 yards per out run, gets up to a career high in targets per out run, also elevates his yards per target side of it. Those are sort of the two elements that go into the yards per out run. So he earned a little bit more volume, was efficient in kind of a tough spot, right? Tough situation, because Russ wasn't playing very well. At the same time, like, Sutton's targets per out run were same decent ranges he's been in, you know, weighted targets per out run, same decent ranges he's been in. He just had a career worst yards per target. And, you know, Russell Wilson was pretty poor. And I don't think Sutton's dust by any means. He's another one that he's right in that turn off the wide receiver window. And I've heard a lot of people say he's sort of outside the wide receiver window. I'm with you, where I'm like, he's one of the last guys I actually think does have an upside profile. And I consider him still like a part of, you know, I kind of consider him to be the last before the wide receiver window. So I have taken a decent amount of him, because I'm feeling like, okay, after him is where it drops off. So yeah, he's an interesting one.
Yeah, those are good notes though on the Jeudy per route run stuff, which is, you know, why we use the rate stats, because you know, me being kind of a mouth breather, just looking up the catches to games played there is a bit misleading. I do feel a little bit better about Judy and his upside after hearing you talk through that. Marvin Mims and Tim Patrick, though, are two other guys we need to talk about, where Tim Patrick just seems to always play more than we want him to or expect him to. And then they bring in Marvin Mims, who I'm squeamish on Mims just because historically I feel like in general in our bubble, Ben, is there's been these rookie wide receivers that we like.
I'm laughing because you're totally right about this point.
Well, we have these guys we like, and then Mims was one of them, like pre-draft was like, oh, this guy could be like a trend. This could be like the sleeper. And then he gets, you know, decent draft capital and decent spot. And he like, and now it's like assumed Marvin Mims is going to be, I shouldn't say assumed, like he's going off his wide receiver 70. So like, that's not an egregious price tag, but I am a little worried that like we've thrust too much optimism on him in general when you've looked at like, you know, unless they,
he might not even play in three wide receiver sets.
Right. Right. Yeah.
I saw your projection. You have Patrick for a few more targets. And I was like, I have it 61 to Mims, 40 to Patrick. You have a just under 60 to Patrick and about 50 to Mims. And I'm like, look, yours is probably right, but there's no way I'm changing this or backing down for this. I'm going to keep Martin Gale and KJ Hamler and take Marvin Mims. He does have a great profile. I think he could be a legit, really good player at the NFL level. The thing about Patrick is like, he's always been pretty efficient. He does a little things. Scouts seem to like him, but he's never actually been a target hog or earned big volume or shown an ability to be a real impact receiver other than just like one of these rotational guys. He's probably a good third receiver, but Mims has the potential to be a real impact guy and like sort of maybe one of the ones you might expect for a rookie that would come on later in the year. But yeah, I mean, I think you laid it out well. There's more risk here than, you know, the biggest Mims stands will immediately cop to.
And to be clear, you know, with our upside cases baked in, we definitely have Mims ranked ahead of Tim Patrick, even though we have the base projection shading Tim Patrick's way a little bit. I have in teams where I've drafted, you know, Russ, or even if I'm playing Best Ball Mania and week 17 stacks come into play, and I've mentioned being real bullish on the Chargers, I will throw my personal rank out the window. And that's like a good time for me to get exposure on these guys. Like just grab them somewhere near ADP when the correlation's there. And not worry about being right or wrong. I'm a little pickier when it comes to teams where I don't have that correlation built in.
Makes sense.
That applies to Dulcich a little bit, who you're a little more bullish on these targets for Dulcich at 82. We've got 69. It's tough. We've got a little bit more to Troutman. We've got 29. You've got 17. Albert, I think we have a name mismatch in our sheet, so I'm not sure what your exact projection is, but we've got 13 to him. Talk about snake bit and Albert O last year. Whew. Yeah. But Dulcich, I think, has like pretty meaningful upside. I'm a little bit worried about the base target share, but I do definitely see the upside case for him.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not like taking a ton of him. I'm a little bit more optimistic in this projection than I probably am in practice as we talk through some of these. I do like him. He had the solid ADOT, you know, more of a vertical role last year, and Russ seemed to like him, was efficient with Russ last year. I do think there's like a you know, some meaningful competition here. So I don't think your projection is out of line at all. Obviously Troutman coming over, having the history with New Orleans. One of the funny notes about looking into Sean Payton's history, in his last year in New Orleans, three of the top six guys in receiving yards from that team are on this team now. So it's Adam Troutman. And then he also went and got Marquez Callaway, who was the leader in receiving yards that year. And Lil Jordan Humphrey is the third. And so those former New Orleans guys are like, you know, on this receiver depth chart as well. We already talked about how Mims, Patrick, and KJ Hamler still here too. It's kind of a deep like receiving core, and there's like four viable tight ends because you have Dulcich, Troutman, Alberto. You even have Chris Manhertz comes over, and he's more of a blocking tight end, but has been, you know, on active rosters for most of his career as well. So it's a kind of deep receiving and tight end room, and I'm probably concentrating the targets too much.
There is a squeeze though. I mean, we already hit on with like Mims, Patrick, Judy, Sutton, and then you mentioned how Russ is going to throw to the running backs a little bit, and P. Ryan and Javonte can both catch the ball out of the bat. Like, they're both good at that. And I think that's ultimately kind of where we ended up. Because if you look at the numbers in isolation last year, you know, after the bye week, the average target share for Dulcich was like 17%, which is great. If you played those DFS days, though, you kind of know what you get into with these tight ends, where it was like he would be mega chalk and like totally flop, and then next week would be great. Like very volatile performance. And that's just like the nature, I think, of the tight ends in this range. So that's where in some of the earlier pods we mentioned, like, you know, maybe we just rather build like three tight end teams later as opposed to Dulcich in this window. But I do think he's got a little bit more upside. It just, it is a math problem in terms of making all the targets fit.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, there was fewer receivers for sure last year with no Patrick and no Mims. There's no real third guy. And now there's probably four receivers there, you know, potential target issues.
Let's go to Las Vegas, where we get a quarterback switch from Derek Carr to Jimmy Garoppolo. And we're very similar in play calling, right around 62 plays per game. We have to a T the same pass percentage projected at 61%, which puts this team just over 25 rush attempts per game, just under 35 pass attempts per game. And we've got pretty similar lines on Jimmy Garoppolo. You're a touch higher, I think, on YPA, but in general, like, we bake in some more backup quarterback play. And I'm assuming you're just applying 100% to Jimmy G, but ultimately you've got him at 286 fantasy points over the course of the season in 4 point per passing touchdown. We've got him at 262. And I think the Las Vegas stacks are a little bit undervalued in general, but like, you're obviously only drafting Jimmy if you've grabbed ideally Davante Adams, because even the other values in the passing game aren't like high upside stacks. But anything from a play calling note, or just from, I don't know if we should talk about the quarterback switch here or more so with when we get to Davante.
I guess one big picture thing on them is like, and about this like stack and whether they're undervalued. I thought I went pretty conservative on the TD rates, and then I got done with this whole projection, and I had wound up over projecting their touchdowns by a handful per those Vegas lines that I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. I had to come back and like nuke a lot of the touchdown rates. And a big part of that was Josh Jacobs and Adams get a lot of the volume, and they've had strong TD rates throughout their careers, but I had to bring those down a little bit. And then the ancillary guys had to bring, you know, them down to like kind of below average rates for some of them, because this is an offense that the market does believe isn't going to score a ton, even though Garoppolo is probably a pretty competent quarterback. I mean, I guess like the bet if you're stacking is they're going to beat the market, right? Is that sort of the idea?
Yeah, I think the bet's either they're going to beat the market or just, I mean, Garoppolo is going off as like QB 30. And like historically, he's tough to figure because in the situations he's played have been good for quarterback's efficiency, but like he's been fine. And if you're taking, you know, Davante Adams and you're doing a three quarterback build, you're not taking Jimmy Garoppolo and he managed these, but if you're doing a three quarterback build and I've got Davante Adams, like I just don't have too many issues clicking Jimmy Garoppolo and, you know, literally like round 17 to just correlate those two guys.
It makes sense. I mean, and like, I've had a hard time with the Raiders. I have not taken a lot of these guys. I've taken a little bit of Josh Jacobs in the, at the 2-3 turn. I've taken a little of Adams when he's fallen, especially into the second round. But I mean, last year, this offense was basically like a two-man show, and they didn't, I mean, they bring in Jacoby Myers. They didn't bring in a lot else. Darren Waller's gone. And I mean, it kind of looks like it's going to be the same two-man show, right? I mean, it could be really concentrated and really good for fantasy football again.
Yeah, and let's go to Josh Jacobs. And he is someone that I wouldn't say I've been targeting, but I think I'm slightly overweight on. Just when you get to that 2-3 turn, when, again, like the guys like Devonta Smith, Olave, T, once they go, I'm kind of on Josh Jacobs over the other round three wide receivers. And it's tough because it's a guy that like we did not want to draft last year in like rounds 6 to 8, you know, and now the price tag's much richer. You definitely feel like you're buying high. On the plus side, he was legitimately good. It wasn't like crazy, you know, he was legitimately good, which is a feather in his cap. And then also, I kind of just as a narrative take, you know, this is last year under contract with the Raiders. They don't have anything behind him. I just don't really see any reason why the Raiders are just going to hold back from feeding Josh Jacobs. You mentioned the two-man stuff. And, you know, he catches enough passes. I think the offense should be, like, good enough. So I guess I do have a little bit – I think we do have slight bullishness relative to the team total, which is playing in here. But, yeah, it's, I mean, it's a really good workload to get in the third round for a running back who was actually good last year.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right that the market is saying, look, we got him a lot cheaper last year. I don't want to chase him up necessarily. But yeah, I mean, in this same situation, same backups, I mean, it's still Zamir White, Brandon Bolden, and Amir Abdullah. He had an 80% rush share last year. I mean, that's not just running back rushes. He had, like, I think over 90% of the running back rushes, or right around 90%. Didn't have a mobile quarterback, still doesn't have a mobile quarterback. Backup running backs totaled 38 carries, and Jacobs had like 350 or something. I don't have the number in front of me, but a huge amount. There is a question of, like, can he just take on that much volume again this year, do it back-to-back seasons? But as far as a projection goes, like, I wound up projecting, again, the backup running backs had 38 last year. I wound up projecting like almost 100 to Zamir White, Bolden, and Abdullah, which there's not really any reason to do that. I'm not really sure why I'm projecting the backups to have, you know, 2.5 times as many carries as they had last year. And still I have Josh Jacobs for nearly 300 carries in this projection, right? Like, it's kind of hard to, like, quantify in a projection how extreme he dominated this backfield last year. But I mean, there's definitely a case for saying, I'm just going to bet into him being able to repeat that.
Yeah. The question is, kind of with backs of his nature that we've avoided systemically at times, is like, you know, is he actually that? He had the really good year last year, but like, is he actually that good? Does the offense, you know, the offense is at risk here, and do we want to take it back like that in the third round? Like, I think Ramondre Stevenson's kind of a similar thing in the third round here. You know, he's a little bit younger, but I think it's like another offense that doesn't have a really good team total, and it's like, if the offense craters. But I think, like, Jacobs has less risk to his workload than a Ramondre Stevenson, which is why I kind of have Jacobs ahead.
I think they're real close. That's tough. Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's tough. But Jacobs just, yeah, I don't know. I mean, last year, at least, like, I think about him in comparison to like a Najee Harris, who's one where we have not seen efficiency at the NFL level yet, but he still could project for a lot of volume. He's going a lot later. I mean, he's fallen into the fourth round in a lot of cases, but there's a reason I'm still out on Najee. With Jacobs last year, we saw the efficiency, as you said. Like, we didn't just see him dominate the workload. We saw efficiency with it. Like, he had a really good year, full stop. Like, both sides, you know, increased to borderline elite levels. And it's just like, how much do you bank on both of those, the workhorse level and the efficiency elevating to new extremes? But I mean, I think you can make that bet. I don't think there's a reason you can't.
Yeah. Ultimately, I guess I don't feel super strongly at the end of the day. Just kind of like, when those receivers of the 2-3 turn are gone, I think he should be in play there and shouldn't be overlooked. I don't have any backup running backs on the Raiders. Just don't really feel confident that in any of these guys. Sounds like you're similar. Let's go to Davante Adams. And I'm pretty bullish on Davante Adams for the second straight year, where I kind of feel like he's just really, really good, and the market kind of finds reasons to not want to play him. And that's put, you know, maybe too simply, but I think with the quarterback switch, I don't know if it's that much of a drop off from Carr to Jimmy G. You know, I'm not sure it's that much of a drop off to hinder Davante Adams, who, you know, last year, I think his catch rate's going to come way up this year. I think his yards per catch is probably going to come down. He had a little bit of a weird year last year and how he got there for sure, but
career high ADOT. Yeah.
Just his talent though, the way he's used around the goal line, that was something we weren't sure if that would carry over from playing with Aaron Rodgers, and they seemed to kind of still run those routes by the goal line that Green Bay would run to Davante Adams. So I don't know. I just feel really good about him. I've backed off a little bit where like I was like a super Davante bull, but I think he's a great pick at the end of the first round. And I do think you can make arguments for him over like AJ Brown, CeeDee Lamb, Amon-Ra. I'm not going to, you know, totally go on a limb and say like he's for sure the guy there. I think it's a tier, but I do think he belongs in that tier of those guys who are kind of going ahead of him. At least AJ Brown and CD are like super consistently going ahead of Davante.
Yeah, I don't have a strong take on him. I think everything you just said is very fair. I mean he's dealing with another QB change if you want to be concerned, but I just pulled up my targets per out run right up from earlier in the winter over at my Substack, something I've referenced a couple times on the show here. And that big write-up I wrote about all the players, and I wrote about Adams. My big takeaway from 2022 on him was I was too concerned about the last QB change. Any concern at all was too much because he's just so good. And like, you know, I'm kind of concerned that if I'm concerned about Garoppolo, I'm probably going to make the same mistake. I mean, last year I was a little bit lower on him in that tier with Lamb and Diggs. I had Lamb and Diggs ranked ahead of him. And I mean, he just showed last year, like he wasn't just all Rodgers, obviously. He's just really, really good.
Yeah. So pretty bullish on him. And this is where, again, just the Raiders offense is tough, where like on paper, I think like Jacoby Myers and Hunter Renfrow are also like decent values, but you're getting to the point where I don't want to be investing in too much in the Raiders team that doesn't have a great team total. And I don't know if we should be putting any stock into like Davante Adams has already sort of complained like before the offseason has even gotten underway too much in terms of like training camp and stuff that he's worried about the offense and things like that. And so the concern for me is just a systemic risk that maybe this does blow up more than we're expecting. But yeah, with Darren Waller out, like I think Myers and Renfrow, you know, they're kind of target earners. I wonder too, I said Davante Adams' catch rate would go up, yards per catch probably goes down, but it does seem like it's setting up for him to be the downfield guy again with the way that Jacoby and Renfrow work. It seemed like they've been trying to move Renfrow, so with no success, obviously. So I don't know exactly what'll happen there, but as a really
It's weird to project him, right? Like we both have Jacoby Myers almost 90 targets and Renfrow between 70 and 75. But I put in my notes, like, it doesn't really compute to project these two for the combined number I have. Myers does have a little bit of a higher ADOT. I was looking into their slot rates. Both of them the last 3 years have played about two-thirds of their snaps in the slot. They could, I mean, maybe coexist a little bit where Myers is running a little bit of a higher ADOT. Renfrow's your typical slot, really shallow ADOT kind of guy, like 7 ADOT, and Myers is up around 10. But, like, other than that, they just seem super redundant. I couldn't even find anything really that's like differentiates them. They would seem to play the same role in an offense.
Yeah, it's definitely confusing, but they are guys that I've taken where just looking at the targets they've earned historically, even with Davante Adams here, I feel like, okay, I can't go lower than the numbers I'm inputting here, right? Like even if Renfrow went somewhere else, like he's, and unless he just gets like benched for Jacoby Myers, like, and isn't on the field, which it seems like that's not going to happen, but it's possible, you know, that's where I've been wrong before. That's kind of what I said with Kenny Galladay last year. I was like, well, if he at least plays, he'll be fine. And he, you know, it was so bad. So sometimes the at least doesn't come to fruition, but you know, we've got a 12% target share for Hunter Renfrow, like, and he pops quite a bit because, you know, that's not too bad. Again, in best ball, if you're building these rosters too, especially if you do like hyper fragile now, which you can do with some of these running back values early and you're drafting like 9 wide receivers, I don't mind grabbing Hunter Renfrow. Just, you know, he's going to get targets. And Myers is someone where I don't want to be drafting wide receiver at that point in time. But if I have to, you know, I'm okay clicking him.
There's not much else there, right? Trey Tucker's the rookie. kind of got outperformed at Cincinnati by Tyler Scott. Probably not, you know, he's a good athlete, but he's kind of undersized. He's fast. Probably not like a big impact player right away. Keelan Cole's still there. But I mean, this is a team where Mack Holland stepped into a career year at like age 29 last year, just and ran a ton of routes, ran over 600 routes because they, I mean, I feel like they got to get Myers and Renfro on the field together if they're both on the roster, because they're don't like they're so clearly better than the rest of the receivers, right?
Yeah, that makes sense. Makes me feel better about our rankings. I know relative to ADP, we're higher, which doesn't mean like you're getting a ton because you're not necessarily in position to draft like 16th round Hunter Renfro all the time. But if you are, I think you should feel like okay clicking that. But just understand the type of player you're getting. Like, you know, you're not taking a huge upside swing, but you are getting a guy who's more likely to be on the field and see targets than a lot of the other players available around his ADP. To go to tight end, Michael Mayer. I've had a tough time with these rookie tight ends. I forgot who I was talking to, but they were, someone was trying to make the point to me that, you know, the difference between Mayer and Kincaid shouldn't be as wide as it is. I wasn't totally buying that because I think Kincaid is one, like obviously in a better offense. Two, I feel a little bit better that he's like basically there to catch passes, whereas Mayer is playing, you know, maybe more, I don't know if traditional tight ends the right word. You can kind of correct me there, Ben, as far as the setup. But these rookie tight ends historically, you know, they don't do that well. So maybe I'm making homer excuses for Kincaid, but Mayer is someone that I haven't gotten much of. I totally get taking him late where it's like the risks, like who cares, but you can get legitimate starting tight ends late. So I don't know. How are you approaching Mayer?
I probably would have said what you heard from anonymous source about the gap being a little too wide, that because Mayer's a good prospect and was, you know, productive prospect. I came out of this projection thinking it's tough for the tight ends in this offense with Devontae as an alpha target earner and then basically two target earning slots as the other two receivers in terms of like depth of target overlap. You know, Jimmy G historically has thrown at tight ends a lot, but like that's been the offense he's been in. I just don't see like, and then you also have Austin Hooper here. You even have OJ Howard as another veteran tight end three. I have him projected for seven targets, but there are other guys that can play and sort of not. Mayer looks to me with this projection and in this setup like a rookie tight end that is going to have the type of rookie tight end season that we are often afraid of, which is that, you know, rookie tight ends often don't smash in year one. Kincaid, you can tell yourself that other story where like he's just going to be their slot receiver and he fits into a high volume offense that's going to score a bunch of points and he can have a high TD rate. I think to bet on rookie tight ends because of the long-term trends, like you want to be able to tell yourself a story and a projection that he fits into this offense really well. And I can see some scenarios where even if his target volume is not super high or his routes aren't super high, he can hit on efficiency and all these things. I look at this for Mayer and I'm going, man, I don't really see where the targets come from. It's a tough situation. He's a good player, I think, long-term, good dynasty player to have, but I don't want to probably take a ton of him in redraft.
Yeah, these tight ends definitely, you know, they take time. And, you know, if we're worried about the team total, you know, a lot of times the tight ends late that are getting there, you know, they're fine in the end zone a decent bit. Whereas some of these arguments for the other players on the Raiders, obviously you want the offense to be good. You want the offense to score, but we can get there on catch volume a little bit more. So that's sort of, I guess, the difference. You know, I don't blame anyone for taking shots on a talented rookie tight end super late. He's gotten to the point where he just basically goes at the very end of drafts. You know, for a while there, he was going more like round 15 or so. So I get it, but I also understand that you can get, you know, Hunter Henry and Mike Gesicki crazy late and just feel better about, you know, those types of players.
I might feel different if we didn't have those cheap veterans that we liked in the AFC East episode.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, this was a great episode, a little bit longer one, but there was so much to talk through with these teams. And the NFC West is going to be really interesting to talk through as well. So I think that'll be another long episode to finish us up, though. 7 of 8 done. We've got one more. If it isn't already on the ETE feed, it should be up pretty soon. You can check it out again on iTunes. Rate, review, helps us a lot to keep doing these types of episodes for free. Same thing on the Established Run YouTube channel. Subscribe, give us a thumbs up, and also make sure you're following Ben at Yards Per Gretsch on Twitter and signed up for his newsletter, bengretsch.substack.com. Really invaluable source of information, no matter what type of fantasy you're playing throughout the year. Thanks so much for tuning in, everybody. See you next time.